You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate Brian Hagedorn has responded to criticism stemming from his history of condemning homosexuality. We'll find out about the back and forth during our state news roundup. First, members of Wisconsin's Black Legislative Caucus announced that they would honor prominent African Americans with ties to Wisconsin with a Black History Month resolution. Those mentioned include former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Baseball Hall of Famer Reggie Jackson, as well as less high-profile residents of the state. But the resolution hit a snag when some Republican lawmakers took issue with the inclusion of former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Kaepernick has been controversial in some circles for taking a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality against African Americans, an action that spread throughout the NFL and to other sports. Representative David Crowley joins us now to talk about the issue. Crowley is a Democrat representing the 17th District in the Wisconsin State Assembly, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Crowley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me here. Glad to be here.
So who did the legislature's Black Caucus want to include in this Black History Month resolution?
We wanted to include a lot of different people, actually, folks who served in the legislature for like Lucia Palmer, who was the first person African American to serve in the legislature, to Marsha Cox, who was the first African American woman to serve in the legislature, as well as pastors, community leaders like Pastor Greg Lewis, but also Colin Kaepernick. Wanted to recognize folks who are doing things in the community as well currently in history.
Well, and these are African-American people who have ties to Wisconsin, and some of our listeners might not realize that Colin Kaepernick does. Can you tell us what that connection is?
Yeah, he was actually born in Milwaukee and raised in Wisconsin. He's also, as a philanthropist, has given dollars to youth organizations here in the city of Milwaukee, youth organizations such as Urban Underground. So he has definitely done a lot, not just being born here, but also, being a great athlete on the field as well.
Depending on where someone might stand on the issue, Colin Kaepernick has been a controversial figure to many people. Mm-hmm. Were you, though, surprised that some of your colleagues in the legislature pushed back on his inclusion in this resolution?
I'm not totally surprised. I knew that there would be some talks. But the way that it was handled was really inappropriately. Nobody really talked to us beforehand until it came to the day of, even though we had it out for at least 2 weeks, a week in advance for folks to look at. So there was opportunity to have dialogue in the beginning of it, but they never once reached out to myself or the Black Legislative Caucus to have a conversation. So, we were surprised at their tactics of how we felt like we were being rolled over.
And so what was the first indication that you and other members of the Black Caucus received that there was opposition to including Colin Kaepernick in the resolution?
We got kind of a heads up ahead of time, I think. We didn't necessarily know. We've seen that there was a resolution scheduled. But what we learned was it was actually authored by the majority leader, Speaker Voss, and Jim Steinke. And so when we seen that it was theirs that was put up, that's when we realized that they weren't actually taking consideration of what we had actually put forward and weren't willing to really debate about it either. And so that's when we actually objected to actually having that one put up and really forced their hand to actually taking up our resolution.
Have you had any conversations since that happened with Assembly Majority Leader Steinke or with Speaker Voss personally?
Not since we've had session, but I'm hoping that we can have some dialogue in the future about how we can handle this. This is the second year that this has happened. Last year we had two simultaneous Black History Month resolutions put forward, one from one particular Republican, and one from our Black Caucus again. And so I'm hoping that we can have some dialogue and actually find some resolution moving forward.
We're talking right now with Representative David Crawley. He's a Democrat representing the 17th District in the Wisconsin State Assembly. That district includes Milwaukee. And we're talking about the fact that a resolution for Black History Month that was put forward by Representative Crawley and other members of the Black Legislative Caucus was rejected by other members of the legislature because of the inclusion of NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick. And Representative Crawley, what message do you think this sends to the rest of the country about Wisconsin? It's a story that's been picked up nationally.
Yeah, definitely didn't think it would go this far. But I mean, it's really about, you know, the fact that, you know, we had Black legislators who were elected to represent, if not majority of the Black residents here in the state of Wisconsin, to put forth these types of things, these types of resolutions to honor folks. And so to see the fact that we have a majority white Republican party, for the exception of one person of color who's actually elected, on their side, you know, to see them actually reject the Black caucus and what we were doing for the people that we represent was really a slap in the face for us. And so, you know, I think it sends a message that a lot of people look at this as politics. This isn't just about politics. This is not politics. You know, folks may agree with or disagree with his methods, Colin Kaepernick's methods, but the message that he's been putting forward as far as trying to bring awareness to police brutality, to the racial injustice throughout the country, I think that has resonated with many folks. And I think that it has actually started us having a more deeper conversation, but we also need to push that forward.
Do you feel like this is partly an issue of how people's images or how they're thought of changes over time? Because some of the, I would say, African-American leaders and heroes who are pointed to today in their own time were actually considered pretty controversial. I'm thinking of Muhammad Ali, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and others.
And you made you hit the nail right on the head, right? Like, many of the people that we recognize today wouldn't have been coming into these chambers, wouldn't be recognizing these chambers if it was history in the making. And what we do know is that when history is being made, it is controversial. And so it's going to take some time for people to understand what's going on. Because in my opinion, many of the people that we had on our Black History Resolution, including Colin Kaepernick, you know, my children, my grandchildren will possibly be reading about these folks in history books. And so I think it's impactful and it's important that we also give, you know, the flowers to those who are currently making history and those who have made history while they're here before they leave.
I asked you, Representative Crawley, how this is might be appearing to people outside of Wisconsin as they read about this news. What are you hearing from your constituents and African Americans in Wisconsin about how they are seeing this action up at the Capitol?
We received a lot of support, actually. We also received a little bit of hate as well. But the support has been really overwhelming. People have been asking what are the next steps. And so we've been having a lot of different things every year. In February, we like to have different events happening. You know, this week we focus on mental health and health in the African-American community. Next week we'll be focusing on criminal justice. But we're also going to have a lobby day that's going to be on February 28th. And so we're going to have many folks throughout the state of Wisconsin, not just African-American, but folks who understand the issues that affect people of color throughout the state, to really push the issues and really lobby and learn some about some of the tactics that of how to talk to your legislator and really get folks really engaged about moving issues forward affecting Black people and people of color throughout the state of Wisconsin. Because it's in our opinion, and I think it's reality, that when we all do better, we all do better. So it's important that we focus on all the issues and understand that many of these crossroads that we're at right now, we can really come together and really tackle the issues that we're facing.
Before we let you go, yesterday on Central Time, we talked about the history of blackface and the many instances that have been in the news lately of high-profile public figures having appeared in blackface years ago or more recently. Can I ask you to comment on this moment in our culture and that blackface is still such an issue today?
It's astonishing. It's astonishing that we are still going through this today. And that we're, you know, we're learning more and more about folks, and it's you know, for me, I'm realizing that there's a spectrum of when people were ignorant and somewhat, you know, woke up at some point. But I think that it's a conversation that we all need to be having right now, because I think we're understanding that there's a lot of not only racism, but prejudice and discrimination that is happening and bigotry that's happening in this country right now, that we have to have a real discussion on how we get rid of this. We don't need our kids coming into this world and seeing this as a norm at this time. And so we need to figure out ways to really have a deeper conversation of eradicating all of this. It's going to be a part of our culture, but we have to understand that until we address it, of being a part of our culture and how long it's been a part of our culture, is going to be very hard to move forward.
Representative Crawley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me again, Judy. I appreciate it.
Representative David Crawley is a Democrat representing the 17th District in the Wisconsin State Assembly. That district includes Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a resolution to honor prominent African Americans with Wisconsin ties that included former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick and the controversy surrounding the issue in the state legislature. We're taking a look at some of this week's news from around the state. A Supreme Court candidate is under scrutiny for his record on LGBT issues. Officials in northern Wisconsin are pushing for a return of the tax reciprocity agreement with Minnesota, and a historic hotel in Green Bay is reopening after a nearly decade-long remodeling effort. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Judith, hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How
great.
Are you?
I'm good. Well, let's dig right in. There's a lot to cover. So on April 2nd, we'll have an election for a Wisconsin State Supreme Court seat. Brian Hagedorn, who's running against Lisa Neubauer, is facing criticism for his role in founding a K-8 school in Waukesha that essentially bans LGBT students, staff, and parents. What do we know about this?
Right. So this is a Christian private school that Hagedorn founded in 2016, and he's on the board of now. And the school has an official policy that states that you know same-sex marriage violates its religious beliefs. Teachers may be fired and students may be expelled if they or their parents violate the school's code. So by its letter, this could refer to any sexual activity outside of marriage. In practice, most people would interpret it as being primarily aimed at people who are gay. And the policy does explicitly state that same-sex marriage is, you know, is in opposition. This is something that private schools, Christian schools, do. By no means is this is Hagedorn School, the Augustine Academy, unique in this way. But you know, it raises the issue for somebody who's running to be a judge about, you know, his impartiality on issues like that as a judge.
And how has he responded to these reports?
Well, so the context here is these reports this week came after earlier report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel uncovering some old blog posts that he made in 2006-2007 when he was a law student that were quite, you know, stridently socially conservative, let's say. He referred to himself and understood himself to be a culture warrior on the right wing side of the culture war, and so he was doing activism, which is, that's politics. You can say what you want on your blog, but for a judge, it's not really consistent with the image that a lot of people at least say they want. And so for the Democratic side, they say that this is a, you know, they have an interest in playing up the way that he is engaged in these partisan politics. So okay, so that's background. his statement at that time was, his campaign statement, I should say, is that he set that aside when he became a judge. A judge's job is to interpret the law and follow the law, and he is an impartial judge and has shown that in his career as a judge. So this came out that this, you know, this private school was founded in 2016 while he was a judge. So so the argument here is like, you know, it's this side of him is still a part of him. And so, you know, so for people who agree or don't see that as an issue, that will be understood as just another expression of his religious views. But, you know, this is politics, and that's the question that's being raised, is where he separates his own politics from his judging.
Do we have any sense yet whether this might either win or lose him votes in April?
So, you know, there's not a primary in this race. So there's he's going to be the conservative side's justice here. And the April election is a low turnout affair, always and forever. And so, you know, the people who tend to vote are people who are quite engaged in politics, right? On the other hand, I think that you know, it's not a coincidence. This is being pushed. These stories are being trumpeted by the left-wing side of the argument, right? Their view is that they are sounding an alarm or, whipping up their base, the liberal base, to show up to oppose this guy.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau and joins us almost every week at this time to talk about some of the big news stories from around the state. And Rob, let's move on to tax reciprocity. So public officials from northwestern Wisconsin are pushing state leaders to bring back the tax reciprocity system that existed with Minnesota in the past. It ended about 10 years ago. What exactly did that program do?
Well, so first of all, I'm surprised that you would stoop to such clickbait as to talk about tax reciprocity here. It's like, it's so sensationalized. So what it is for people who live in one state but work in another state. So if you live in Superior and you work in Duluth, it turns out to be a giant hassle to pay your income taxes. You have to file in two states. It's a whole thing, right? So it used to be that Wisconsin and Minnesota had a deal to do with this. You could file taxes in one place, and then the bookkeepers would sort it out and, you know, sort of settle up at a future date. But in 2009, the governor of Minnesota canceled that. He said that Wisconsin was not paying Minnesota what it owed quickly enough. And so now, with the new administration here, there's discussion of raising it again, and it is something. I mean, it's not like a giant issue in central Wisconsin where I live, or in Madison perhaps, but like along the borders, like this does affect a certain number of people, and it would improve their lives to be able to file taxes just once. So,
and are we hearing anything from the other side of the border about whether they're open to reinstating this?
So first, a fact to know is that there are more people who live in Wisconsin and work in Minnesota than vice versa. So Wisconsin always would end up owing money, about $106 million per year to Minnesota. You know, that's not money coming out of Wisconsin's pockets. It was not our money in the first place, but like that's the direction the payments go. And so from Minnesota's point of view, they might sort of feel like, why should we have to wait? Let's just get our, you know, it's not as good of a deal for them. However, Minnesota administration say they're open to it. You never know. It could come back.
So the Hotel Northland, this week in Green Bay, the Hotel Northland officially opened its doors. But for people in the area, this was not an average hotel opening. It's a nearly century-old landmark, and there was about a decade of ups and downs in this project. What took so long to bring this hotel back to life?
Yeah, this has been quite a saga for the people of Green Bay. So the building is like right downtown. It's kind of this magnificent building, and opened as a fancy hotel in 1924. By the 70s, it had become pretty run down, and it was used as, like, housing for the elderly. And it was in 2010 that city leaders decided, like, this might be a place for redevelopment. Maybe somebody will want to turn this back into a fancy hotel again. And as you say, it's taken forever. So one developer went bankrupt, and there were, like, legal complications to it. And it's just been quite a millstone, a project around Green Bay's neck. This spot right in the middle of downtown that was sitting unused. So it's a pretty significant thing for Green Bay people, or just people who go to Green Bay. On Valentine's Day, the renovated hotel Northland opened after a renovation of like $50 million went into that, all told. And so it's up and running now.
Great. Well, before we let you go, Rob, we've gone from extreme cold to extreme snow. Now it's getting cold again in much of the state. The last snowfall was actually record-breaking in your part of the state. Can you put in perspective for us what it was like having that much snow dumped on you so quickly?
So this is a lot of snow. This is a four shoveling day. This is a four times out in the driveway kind of day. Yeah, this was, the National Weather Service said this was Wisconsin's greatest February snowstorm, which is nice, I think. And don't get it confused here. People want to talk about, like, you set a snowfall record for that day in history, but here in Wausau, at least, it was 15.7 inches of snow. It was the most single day snowfall. It broke the record of 1908, so of any day. That gets to be a lot of snow, I'll tell you.
So did you put your little guy to work out there on those four shoveling trips?
Yeah, I supervised. I had hot chocolate and was inside, but my 7-year-old did a great job, I thought, of clearing the whole space. And it was all right.
Awesome.
No, we worked together on it. It was good.
Very
it was father son bonding.
Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. Well, Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Rob Menzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joined us for a look at some of the week's top state news. Facebook celebrated its 15th birthday last week, giving us a chance to take stock of how the social network has influenced our lives. In a recent article, our next guest took a closer look at one of the effects Facebook has had on us and the way we think about friendships. Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her recent piece is titled Facebook, Where Friendships Go to Never Quite Die. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So, 15 years, first of all, 15 years of Facebook, that's kind of hard to believe. But what are these new kinds of friends or friendships that Facebook has really created and fostered?
You know, it's interesting. I think there's tons of things that one could say about what effects Facebook has had on social life. But to me, what stands out the most and what is the most qualitatively different is this wide network that Facebook users have of what researchers call weak ties, or, you know, I call them vestigial friendships, which is just, you know, the friends that would have normally fallen out of your life as you sort of evolved out of needing them. And for most of human history, they would have not stuck around, but because of Facebook, they're just sort of lingering on, and you still ambiently know what everybody is up to. And I think that's a very different experience of a social relationship than humans have had for most of history.
Well, and I think it's really interesting because I was thinking about my own experience on Facebook, and I'm in my early 50s. So some of those relationships had kind of drifted away. I think you talk in your article about, for instance, the friends that you were close to in grade school or high school, but then you kind of drifted away when you weren't in school together and your lives kind of took different directions. But then a lot of those people find each other again later once Facebook makes that possible. And so there are those friendships, but they were kind of on pause for a while too for a lot of us.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do think there are sort of different, you know, microgenerational differences in how people have experienced this. Like, a lot of young adults, I think, have basically been on Facebook for half their lives at this point. And that's sort of a situation where it's documenting in real time how you're friending people and then kind of drifting away from them, but then they're still just in the historical record. But I think there's also a sort of shared cultural understanding that these kind of old friendships that you've lost touch with are what Facebook is for to a degree. And people who may have, you know, joined Facebook when they were older often will go and specifically seek out these people who have fallen out of their lives. So whether you're coming at it from either direction, I think we all kind of know that that is one of its major functions.
You talked with a sociologist who, in fact, set up her Facebook account specifically to find and connect with people from her high school. She even used a photo of herself from high school to make it easier for them to figure out that it was her. Can you tell us about her experience as kind of a microcosm of this?
Well, I mean, I can do my best to sort of relay what she told me, but she's in her 60s, I want to say, and she had a professional Facebook already. I don't think she'd had it for a super long time, but maybe a couple years. And then when she went to set up her personal Facebook, which I believe she did last year, she said, yeah, you know, everybody who knows me now already knows me. They know what I look like. They recognize me. I wanted to see who was going to recognize, you know, my young self. And so I put up my high school photo to try to find some of these people that she'd fallen out of touch with.
And did she tell you what, I'm assuming that it worked, at least to some degree, what was that like?
I think it worked to a degree. She didn't tell me too much about, you know, if she reconnected with anybody or you know, started chatting with any old friends again. But I do think that that happens for a lot of people.
We're talking with Julie Beck right now. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and her recent piece is titled Facebook, Where Friendships Go to Never Quite Die. Facebook just turned 15 this week, so it's a good time to look at how it's affected our friendships and our relationships. And so, Julie, what are some of the positive aspects of having this big, pretty loosely connected in many ways, network of friends, in quotes, as in the Facebook friend?
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, it's not all good, it's not all bad, but it is all new and it is kind of strange when you take the long view of it. So, you know, I mean, it can be nice to get back in touch with people who you might never have heard from again or never have known what they were up to except maybe at a high school reunion or something. And a lot of, there has been some research on these weak ties and people have found that they tend to be more different to you than your closest friends, who tend to be, you know, pretty similar to you, whether that's socioeconomically or, you know, just geographically because you meet friends where you live. And so the weaker ties will tend to be more different from you, and so that's a way that you can be exposed to new perspectives that you might not have otherwise seen. And, of course, that can be good or bad, right? We've all had the experience of somebody posting a Facebook rant that we don't agree with, and it's like some, you know, random acquaintance from the past. But yeah, a lot of times that can really diversify your worldview. And a lot of times too, people will, put out requests for help to their wider Facebook network. And, you know, that could be anything from, you know, what book should I read next? Or, you know, I'm going through a really hard time and like, I really need some, you know, does anybody know what resources could help me? And research has found that people do tend to respond to those requests. And it may be that, you know, your more tertiary acquaintances are the ones who have the information that you need, maybe because they are more different from you.
So on the plus side, it can get us out of our bubble. It can also, you know, provide more support in times in a variety of ways when we need it. What about negative social effects it could have?
I mean, I think, you know, I think we've all kind of had the experience of somebody maybe posting too much or, you know, you might want to have access to these people for nostalgic reasons, like, you know, oh, we used to be really close and it's like nice to have this catalog of memories, but, you know, maybe their new posts are annoying and the memories get a little bit spoiled. Or maybe there are, you know, fights between all these people of different perspectives in the comment section of something you posted and it gets out of hand. So there's a lot of that. And then it's also just, you know, to what degree is that manageable for you? We only have so much attention and so many cognitive resources that we can give to our social life. And do you feel like you're sort of spreading them too thinly among all these people?
Well, and that's interesting because you do refer to research that shows how many friends we can kind of mentally and emotionally manage, very close, a little further out, acquaintances. What does that research tell us?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is, you know, it's not a hard and fast rule necessarily, but there is this anthropologist, Robin Dunbar, who did some research on just, you know, how many acquaintances, friends can we keep track of, and, you know, they call it Dunbar's number, but it's really a series of numbers, and so the one that gets cited the most often is 150, and again, that's approximate, you know, it could be a bit more for some people, a bit less for others. But that is the number of casual friends that you're mentally able to keep track of. And then if you zoom in on that, the smallest circle is 5, and that's like your closest friends, your most intimate people, and that could be some family, some friends, combination thereof, and, you know, people can kind of drift in and out of that circle. Your closest friends today might not be what they were a year ago, et cetera. And then I think 50 is close friends, 150 casual friends, and then you zoom out again, and I believe it's 500 acquaintances. And then the biggest number is 1,500, which is just literally how many faces can you put a name to.
And yet there are many people who have thousands of friends on Facebook. Does that mean that, I mean, maybe are they just using it as kind of a networking, that they don't really think of those people as friends?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for what everybody's reason is. I think a lot of people's Facebook network is definitely extending into the range of at least acquaintances and maybe just faces you can put a name to, and maybe even beyond that. I think another common experience is like someone you haven't spoken to in a long time gets married and changes their name, and then you're like, oh, who is that? I don't remember this person. So, I mean, again, but Facebook makes it very easy for you to keep those people around. You have to do something to get rid of them. Like, you have to decide, I want to unfriend you. And because there are a lot of ways that this wide network is very useful, you may decide you don't want to go to the trouble of, like, culling your friends list and deciding who do you want to keep, who do you want to not keep, and just kind of keep that resource around.
We're talking with Julie Beck of The Atlantic about the 15-year anniversary of Facebook and the impact it's had on our social connections and how we think of friendship. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Who are the people you call friends on Facebook? Are they only the people you're somewhat close with? Or is it kind of a hodgepodge group of people you've maybe met once or used to work with or went to school with years ago? Do you like being reminded what all of those people are doing? Or do you wish some of those relationships would just fade away as they might have before social media existed? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time after this short break. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about Facebook and the way it's extended the shelf life of some friendships or acquaintances in our lives. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these forever or potentially forever friends that exist on Facebook? Are you friends with someone that you would not make a point of seeing in real life? And are you someone with a friends list in the thousands? If so, what do you get out of those connections? On the other hand, are you someone who's quit Facebook altogether or never tried? Give us a call and share your thoughts on Facebook's effect on friendships at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones and talk with Jim in Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I use Facebook. I started a few years ago, and I put it down at times also. And I found a lot of old friends on it. And then my sister wondered, why do I have thousands of friends? And I had to explain to her that I'm using it more as a marketing tool. I collect a bunch of names as I can. If I have 5,000 people, I can get a message across to 5,000 people. Mm. That's also important for me, too.
So, Jim, do you think of Facebook as a professional tool, or is it more of a personal way to present yourself and connect with people? Or is it both?
It's a casual thing, because I'm kind of retired, and I just want to get my ideas across, my opinions, of course, and see how the people respond to it.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. And Julie, I personally am friends with people that I know have thousands of friends on Facebook. And I have to say, I do notice that they rarely comment or even click like on my things, I'm guessing because I get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, well, there is, you know, of course, the element here of the black box of the algorithm, right, which none of us know exactly how it works, but, you know, I think it's safe to say that it tends to surface posts from people whose profiles or posts that you interact with the most. So if, you know, you're liking a lot of your best friend's stuff, it'll probably learn and show you more of her stuff. Whereas if you never click on anything from someone else, then you might see less from them. So there is that element that's sort of shaping people's interactions with it too. But it is definitely hard to keep up with everybody that's on your list. And to some degree, it's just sort of a passive consumption of each other's kind of parallel lives more than actually using the platform to interact in a lot of cases.
In looking at this issue, Julie, and thinking about it, what can it do to us if we see, it kind of feels like an electronic version sometimes of the Christmas letter that gets sent out and, you know, the kids are perfect, the dog is great, you know, our home is beautiful. It can be that, or there are some people that can share a lot of really negative things. Is what we see other people posting, does that have an emotional impact on us in the long term?
You know, I'm sure it does, but I think it's hard to say exactly what, because people's experiences of social media are so varied and they use it in a lot of different ways. I think there is a certain, you know, ambient pressure to post the best version of yourself online, and sort of, you know, even people who don't post very much on Facebook at all, they might still post if they have a major life update, you know, like I just got a new job or we had a baby or something like that, just so that people are kind of aware of those milestones in their lives. But, you know, other people may use it, may keep their friends list smaller and feel a little more comfortable being more honest. It really depends. And you know, Facebook doesn't share a lot of data about how people actually use the site. So to some degree, we have to kind of rely on anecdotes here.
I have to say, preparing for talking with you, I was thinking about how I use Facebook, and my rule for whether I should friend someone or keep someone as a friend is if they suggested going to lunch, I would be happy about it. And that might seem like a goofy thing, but it actually tells me a lot about whether that's a connection that I want to make.
I think that's interesting. That's a pretty smart way to do it. I think there's...
Well, thank you.
you know, people have... I've heard of different categories of friendships that researchers will use. And so there's one that's active friendships, and that's like, you know, people you're pretty much regularly in contact with. You generally know what's going on with them. You see them pretty frequently. And then they have dormant friendships, which is you're not really in touch, but it's sort of like your criteria. If you were to stop by their city and you would look them up and get lunch or get a drink or something, and that wouldn't be weird. Mm-hmm. And then the next category is commemorative friendships, which is sort of like you're not in touch. You have very fond memories of them from a different time in your life, and you want to kind of maybe keep them in your periphery on Facebook, but it would be weird if you went to their town and were like, hey, let's get lunch. So I think Facebook has a lot of these dormant and commemorative friendships, and sometimes you don't always know which is which.
Right. Let's go back to the phones, and Jenny in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. This is a fun and interesting topic, so
Thanks.
Thank you for this.
And what did you want to share?
Oh, I just wanted to share, I've had this really interesting phenomenon happen with Facebook where I'm a pretty social person out in the real world, and then on Facebook there are people that I'm sort of tangentially related to, you know, in the real world, and we like crack each other up and have the best Facebook posts and like love each other on there. But when I run into them in public, it's like really awkward to have the conversation.
Because that's not how you know them.
Because that's not how I know them. Yeah, it's just been really interesting to watch that like evolution in how I relate to people.
So Jenny, will you confess, have you actually hid?
Pardon?
Have you hid from them?
I wouldn't say hid, but it is a little awkward.
It's awkward. Thanks for that call. And I think there is something to that, Julie, that, you know, we can actually interact quite a bit with people on Facebook, and then in real life it feels odd.
Yeah, and that was something I was talking about with sources when I was reporting this, is it's sort of like, you know, friendships are context specific, and Facebook is its own environment. It's its own context. And There is research, too, that shows, you know, that the more different platforms you use to communicate with somebody, generally that's a stronger friendship. So if you're, you know, meeting up face-to-face, if you're talking on Facebook, if you're texting, if you're emailing, the more that you layer onto that, it tends to be a deeper friendship, not always. But there, I think there is something there where if Facebook is the only way that you communicate, then if you try to transplant that to a new context, especially if it's like a more intimate context, like talking on the phone or face-to-face, then it's just it just feels weird and it just doesn't work.
Let's go back to the phones, and Tyler in Germantown is up. Hi, Tyler.
Hi.
Hi. What do you want to say?
With the Facebook friends, there's certain friends I have that like I'll never delete, but I haven't spoken to them in like 15 years back from high school because I'll be having like a really bad day or I'll be depressed and I'll just be scrolling through Facebook because I'm bored. And these people, all they seem to post is negative things. And it's hard to say this without sounding like a jerk, but they just post such negative things and make me feel better about my life thinking, oh God, things could be way worse.
Well, thank you, Tyler. Thank you for your honesty. And Julie, you know, I think it's pretty natural what Tyler's doing. We must, on some level, whether we realize it or not, compare ourselves to what other people are doing, saying, thinking, have.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, an instinct that's not specific to Facebook, although Facebook makes it very easy to indulge in that. You know, people are just interested in other people. We're social animals, and that's how it's always been, and this makes it really easy to even without trying sometimes, I mean, it sounds like, you know, Tyler's kind of going through and scrolling through deliberately, but even if you're just like, oh, let me look at Facebook for a couple minutes and do whatever, you become kind of ambiently aware of what other people are up to. Like, I could tell you exactly which of my high school friends are pregnant right now, and it's not because I went and, you know, looked it up specifically, but you just kind of stumble across that information.
So I have to say, I was talking with a coworker here about this, and we found out that both of us have actually unfriended people more often than not on their birthdays because that's when Facebook reminds us of them. And it feels really horrible, but when Facebook pops up and says, would you like to wish so-and-so a happy birthday? And you think, yeah, no, not really. I think for a lot of people, that's a time where you're like, yeah, so why are we friends?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to what I was saying before, where, like, you have to do something to actually not have these people ambiently in your life anymore. And most of the time, you probably don't think about it because maybe they aren't showing up in, you know, the newsfeed algorithm or whatever, or you just don't feel like putting in the effort. But that is the time where maybe it becomes a little easier to do that. And I think it's hard, too, because you don't want to seem rude by unfriending people. There's, like, this whole weird unspoken etiquette. But a lot of times I think people don't mean anything bad by it. They're just like, you know what, we're not really in each other's lives anymore. I want to keep my Facebook a little more intimate or what have you. But it is fraught, for sure.
And Julie, in the 20 seconds we have left, has writing on this changed your attitude towards Facebook?
I would say no, but I also don't post that much, and I can never get off Facebook because it is a very good reporting tool.
There you go. I know what you mean. Well, Julie, thank you so much for spending time with us and helping us think through what Facebook and social media means.
Of course. Happy to. Thanks for having me.
That was Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic. She was with us to talk about her latest piece, which is titled Facebook, Where Friendships Go to Never Quite Die. And you can keep the conversation going, ironically, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us how you use Facebook and whether it's changed and whether you think of the friendships that you have through social media are like friendships in real life. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the national debt has topped $22 trillion for the first time ever. We'll find out what that really means, what makes up the debt, and whether it's a bill that really ever comes due. Over 90 million adults in the U.S. live with obesity, according to recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We'll talk with the author of a memoir about his experience and his efforts to get healthy. That's coming up on Monday on Central Time.